For me, one of the most exciting parts of this program is the keynote address from Professor Nicholas Carnes of Duke University, and it is really a true honor for me to be introducing Nick to all of you today. Nick is really one of the rising young academics in the field of public policy. He is an assistant professor at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. He is also a co-director of the Research Triangle, the Duke, UNC, NC State triangle of the Scholars Strategy Network, a national network that I am honored to be a co-chair of here in Oklahoma, that is committed to connecting academics with practical public policy issues. And Nick and several others, led by Dr. Theda Scotchpole at Harvard, are working on innovative ways to make sure that public policy debates are more informed by academics, and that academics are doing research that has importance for public debates. And you're going to hear from Nick today as he talks about his research on white-collar government, the hidden role of class in economic policymaking, how he is trying to bridge that gap. But among other things, Nick is also a graduate of the University of Tulsa, and go Golden Hurricane, a native of Kansas. And 10 years ago, I didn't think it could have been that long. 10 years ago, I got a call from TU that they had a particularly bright, energetic, passionate intern who was looking for an opportunity. At the time, I was public policy director for Community Action Project of Tulsa, and Nick came and served as an intern under me back in 2004, and it's been a real pleasure and great excitement to see the work that he has done as he's continued his career through TU, did a PhD at Princeton University, and now at the Sanford School at Duke. And as I was thinking about the Summer Policy Institute the last couple of years and working on developing a program, in many ways, Nick is the example of what I hope that some of you in this room will be able to do. Take the skills that you're developing as students, take some of the skills that I hope that you've developed and connections that you have developed during the Summer Policy Institute, and go on to great things in the areas of academia, nonprofit world, politics, if that's what interests you. So I am extremely honored to introduce Nick Carnes, and also want to mention that following his talk today, Nick will be leading one of the breakout sessions talking about careers in public policy that'll just be in one of the rooms around the corner. So please join me in introducing Nick Carnes.
Thanks, David. It's really nice to be back working at Community Action Project for David, and being at the University of Tulsa completely changed my life for the better, so it's really exciting to be back here. So I'm Nick Carnes. I'm a political scientist at Duke University. The people who know me in political science in my home field, yeah, questions? The people who know me in political science? So they know me if they know me in political science, they know that I care a lot about the working class, manual laborers, service industry workers. For one thing, they probably know this is where I come from. So I grew up in Pittsburgh, Kansas, which is about 2 hours north of here. My mom was a waitress. My dad was a construction worker. When I was born, I think they had one high school diploma between the two of them. I paid my way through high school and college doing sort of working class jobs, so I know how to hang sheetrock, I know how to make Cinnabons, I know how to get fired from the world's largest Walmart. if people know me in political science, they know that I come from the working class, and they know that I do research on the issues affecting the working class, so I sort of got started in this vein. doing a study for this guy, David Blatt, on how implementing a taxpayer's bill of rights would really mess things up for low-wage workers and other vulnerable groups in the state of Oklahoma. And ever since I sort of started working for David, all the research I've done has been basically about how to give working-class Americans more of a voice in our political process. So, you know, people who know me in political science, they know I'm the guy from Kansas who does lots of research on how to give workers in this country more of a say in government. Despite all that, in the last major election in my new home state of North Carolina, I did not vote for a single working class candidate. Not one blue-collar worker, manual laborer, service industry worker got my vote in the last major election in North Carolina. Not because I didn't want to vote for someone from the working class, but because, like most Americans, I actually didn't have any say in the matter. So this is my ballot in the 2012 election, general election in North Carolina. And this was the first major election I had voted in North Carolina. I didn't know any of the politicians, so when I got my sample ballot in the mail in October, I went through and I said, okay, I'm going to be a good citizen. I'm going to find out who all these people are before I go to the polls. And one of the things I found out when I was looking at all these different candidates was I wanted to know what do they do for a living, either now or before they got into politics. So I went through and I just wrote down, what's the occupation for each of these people? For the presidential race, it was pretty easy. I knew the Republicans were running a CEO and a career politician. Remember Mitt Romney? Yeah, that was not that long ago. No, I knew Romney was a CEO. I knew Paul Ryan was a career politician. I knew the Libertarians were also running a business owner and an attorney. And I knew that the Democrats were running a former law professor and a former lawyer. So I sort of knew the presidential ticket. The rest of my ballot was sort of a mystery to me. And it was really interesting as I started going through one by one the occupations that I found. For U.S. House of Representatives, my choices were to vote for a CEO or a lawyer. For governor, my choices were to vote for a lawyer or a CEO. Or a political activist. For lieutenant governor, my choices were a teacher and a businessman. So we're starting to see, finally, a little bit of diversity. You have to go down the ballot a little bit farther. But we do eventually see a little bit of occupational diversity. We're still in what I would call sort of white-collar professional jobs, but you know, still a little more diverse. And on down the ballot, I started seeing, you know, basically once I made the lawyer and the CEO arrows in PowerPoint, I was done. Just copy and paste. My choice for attorney general was a lawyer. For secretary of state was a lawyer and a businessman. My choices for superintendent of public instruction were a teacher and a nonprofit director. Hey, that kind of makes sense. My choices for treasurer were a business consultant and a CEO. Also kind of makes sense. My choices for state senate were a university administrator and a real estate mogul, which was really tough because, like, I technically work for this person at Duke University. But, like, if you want to ever buy a house in Durham, it really is helpful to have that person on your side. So I didn't know, like, which... But the worst of all, as a political scientist, it was humiliating to me that my only choice for the General Assembly House of Representatives race was to vote for a sociology professor. It's totally stuck. So when I finally did this exercise, and this is a true story, I really did this exercise when I got this ballot in the mail. You know, we can see a little bit of diversity on my ballot in terms of the kinds of people who are running for public office, but there's also a huge gap. These are all white-collar jobs. These are all professional jobs. There was no one on my ballot who had serious experience doing the kinds of jobs that I had done before I was, you know, in higher ed. There were no construction workers or receptionists or waiters or cashiers. And you know, that to me is a pretty striking feature of our political process. By the time we get to the polls, we don't have any choice but to vote for what I call a white-collar government. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, Nick, I heard some really weird things are going on in North Carolina politics right now. Is this just your wacky state? And the answer is no, it's not. This isn't just a North Carolina thing. If you look nationwide at the percentage of people who do working class jobs, which we'll just define now as manual labor and service industry jobs, those jobs still make up a majority of the labor force. America is still, the backbone of our economy is still working class jobs. In contrast, the typical city council in this country, the average is about 9% of city council members do working class jobs. At the state legislative level, less than 5% of state legislators come from the working class. The average member of Congress spent less than 1.5% of his or her pre-congressional career doing working class jobs. So think like one summer of construction work to train for the football team or something. And no one on the Supreme Court was a blue-collar worker in any serious way before they got into politics. And at least since World War II, no one from the working class has gotten into politics and gone on to become president. So this isn't just sort of a North Carolina thing. It also isn't just a recent thing, just a decline of unions or rise of money or Koch brothers thing. This is actually a very old feature of our political process. So if you look at the demographic makeup of the U.S. Congress in every Congress, every two-year period between 1901 and the present day, during that time, working class people always made up more than 55% of the country. It was a little higher at the start of the 20th century, a little lower. We're down, it's 60-70% in 1901, upper 50% in, where this graph stops in 1996. But during this period, working class people always make up a majority of our country. During that period, people who got into politics from a working class job, so I'm going to leave the working class, get into politics, eventually make it to Congress. Those type of people never made up more than 2% of our Congress. Even during the last few decades, when other historically underrepresented groups like women and racial and ethnic minorities have thankfully started to make progress towards the goal of eventually getting their fair share in our political institutions. Even though our political institutions have started to become more diverse, on this dimension, they really aren't changing in any appreciable way. And they probably won't change anytime soon. So if you look at the makeup of state legislatures, which tends to sort of foreshadow what's going to happen in congressional politics, right? Lots of people in Congress used to be state legislators. You can sort of tell what the demographic direction of federal politicians is going to look like by looking at state politicians, and likewise you can tell where states are going to go by looking at counties, and counties by looking at cities and school boards. If you look at the makeup of state legislatures, in 1976, the typical state legislature was 8% women, 5% people who do manual labor service industry jobs. Flash forward to 2007, the typical state legislature, thankfully, is up to almost a quarter women. But the percentage of working class people has actually, if anything, gone down a little bit. So this is not just a North Carolina thing. This is not just a recent thing. And this isn't a feature of our political process that's just going to go away on its own. This isn't, if you think of this as a problem, it's not a problem that's going to solve itself or that we can just do nothing about and things will get better. So that's where I come in. When I first started doing research as a political scientist, I was really interested in the question of, does all this stuff actually matter? So there's this old school of thought out there that says it really doesn't matter who you elect. They have to answer to voters, they have to answer to party leaders, they have to answer to lobbyists. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what type of job they had before they got into office or how rich they are or anything else. And I wanted to know whether that was true or whether maybe we really should care that so few people from the working class end up in elected office. And so I spent the first part of my career as a researcher, basically my time in my PhD program, just researching that topic. And it looks like I'll spare you sort of the gory details of all the sort of methodologies and data that I collected for that. But I'll cut right to the conclusion. Spoiler alert, yes. The fact that working class people never hold public office or almost never hold public office in this country seriously biases economic policy in favor of the kinds of policies that more affluent Americans tend to prefer. And the big difference between more affluent Americans and working class Americans tends to be on economic issues, and it tends to be that, perhaps understandably, working class people tend to be more progressive or pro-worker on economic issues. They favor more progressive taxes. They favor a more robust social safety net. They favor unemployment insurance and health care coverage. And people who are more affluent, perhaps understandably, tend to be less enthusiastic about those policies. They tend to be more conservative or pro-business. And what political scientists have found just in the last few years is that the exact same thing is true for politicians. So there's just recently been a whole bunch of new studies that show things like this. Is my friend Christian Gross has a paper showing that legislators who had more money in the stock market were less willing to let us go over the fiscal cliff. So you know, yeah, it really matters if they've got a lot of money in the stock market. They're saying, wait a minute, let's don't destroy the stock market. it's the basic message of this research. I'll just cut to the basic message is politicians are people too, right? It doesn't make them bad or good. It doesn't make them, you know, this is not to say that, oh, those politicians got a lot of the money in the stock market, were corrupt or evil or anything like that. They were doing what everyone does, which is they were making decisions based on their own personal views about what was best for government to do. And those happen to be shaped by their life experiences. And every study that's looked at this has found the same basic thing. So there's another study that shows legislators who are wealthier are more opposed to the estate tax. Kind of makes sense. There's a study that shows that legislators who have higher sort of social status, more education, more money, are more opposed to efforts to reduce inequality. Kind of makes sense. And then the gold standard in this research, I think, is of course my stuff. There's research by Nick Carnes showing that politicians from the working class, they're more likely to vote for the progressive position when a bill comes to the floor on Congress. Or my new book, which again, I'll spare the gory details. They're more likely to vote for pro-worker policies. They're more likely to introduce pro-worker policies. They're more likely to fight for pro-worker policies behind the scenes and think seriously that pro-worker policies are what's best for America. Ultimately, the more working class people you have in your, I think, Congress, or I can show your state legislature or your city council, the more progressive or pro-worker your economic policy outcomes are at the end of the day. And so what all this research is basically showing, what I spent like 7 years of my life trying to demonstrate empirically using all the best statistics, is that yes, it really matters that we have so few people from the working class in our political institutions. If Congress looked more like the country that it's supposed to represent, you know, social policies would be more robust, tax policies would be more progressive, regulations on businesses would be more pro-worker, and the fact that we have a white-collar government means that we get a government that's better for white-collar people. Fine. Okay, so that's the point I got to sort of when I was finishing my dissertation. And the big follow-up question that people ask me is, okay, if it's so important that there are no working-class people in political office, why aren't they in political office? What exactly is keeping them out? And when people ask me that question, I have a lot of hunches. Probably all of you have, you know, sort of ideas about why that might be. But the truth is, the field of political science has to answer, we actually don't know. So we don't know what's keeping working class people out of political office. Political science has good research on why there are so few women in political office that has actually yielded concrete insights about how to support female candidates and increase women's representation in our political institutions. We have some research, although not enough, on the shortage of racial and ethnic minorities in political office. So we understand, to some extent, why Congress is, you know, so male, why Congress is so white. What we don't understand, and what we have almost no research whatsoever on, is why there are so few working class Americans in our political institutions. To date, there are 3 studies out there on this topic. 2 of them are by this guy, Nick Carnes, who half the time I don't trust or I'm deeply skeptical of his methods. The other one's fine. It's a good study. So the explanation that I want to talk about today is the one that I think all of you could potentially do the most about, like in the short term, like in the next few years. And that is, I think part of the reason why there are so few working class people in political office has to do with political gatekeepers. And that's a term that I don't know that people who actually work in politics use. In political science, when we use this term, we basically mean the political and civic leaders who identify, recruit, train, and support local candidates. So think politicians who are currently in office, party leaders, interest group leaders, activists, David, journalists, you know, these are the people who are working in and around government who in some way encourage other people to run for political office and who have the resources to help them. I think that if we want to understand why there are so few working class people in political office, this is a good group to start with, political gatekeepers. Why start there? Well, there are a couple of reasons. First of all, everybody needs at least a little or sometimes a huge nudge to run for political office. So one of the things political scientists do know is that almost no one wakes up and says, I really want to run for public office. And if they do, that's usually not the type of person you want in public office. No, everyone who knows what it's like to run a campaign or to actually hold office knows that running a campaign and holding office is really, really hard. It is a huge personal sacrifice. And so almost everyone who ends up doing it has to be nudged or pushed or persuaded or contacted or trained or supported by some kind of gatekeeper, a party leader, a sitting politician, someone who's already in the system who can help them out. Everyone needs gatekeepers. So if we want to understand why one group isn't in our political institutions, gatekeepers are probably a good place to start. The other reason why I think this is a promising explanation is that scholars who study the shortage of other historically underrepresented groups have found that gatekeepers are a big part of the problem. So, for instance, the research on why there are so few women in office, what it's found is that party leaders are systematically underestimate how well a woman will do in an election. So my friend Melody Crowdermeyer did a survey of party leaders in 2008. She surveyed the chairs of every county-level political party in the country. So the Republican chair in Tulsa County, the Democratic chair. And what she found is that when she asked them, would a woman win a race in your county? Many of them said no, even in counties where women were winning elections. They systematically underestimated women's ability to win elections, and they systematically under-recruited women. Other people have found that when you do actually recruit female candidates, they run, and they do great. And so it seems like a big part of the explanation for why there are so few women in office is that gatekeepers underestimate women's chances, are less likely to recruit a female candidate versus a male candidate. So this, you know, seems like a potentially promising explanation, too, for why there are so few working class people in political office. We could imagine the exact same sort of process happening. Party leaders think that working class people can't win elections, don't know many working class people, are less likely to encourage a blue collar worker to run than a white collar professional. This is especially, the another good reason to focus on gatekeepers is all of us can sort of think of the obvious incentives that political gatekeepers might have to recruit white-collar professionals. If you want somebody to win an election, you know they're going to have to do some fundraising. And the higher up you go in the political process, you know, the more fundraising they're going to have to do. So what a lot of political gatekeepers tell me is that when they are thinking about a potential candidate for public office, the first question they ask is, does this person have rich friends? You don't have to be rich yourself, but it's really useful. You know, even if you didn't make a killing yourself, it's really useful if you went to law school with a lot of people who are millionaires, or if you have in your professional network, in your personal network, in your neighborhood, lots of rich people, because you're going to be making a lot of phone calls asking people to support your campaign. Gatekeepers, you know, the people who recruit future candidates, probably have strategic incentives. Even if they love white-collar, or even if they love blue-collar workers, even if they really want more blue-collar workers to run for office, they may have strategic incentives that lead them to pass over candidates from the working class in favor of candidates from business and law and the types of jobs that give us most of our politicians. The other reason why I'm interested in researching gatekeepers is that right now, the few reformers who are trying to increase working-class representation in our political institution are using gatekeeping strategies. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But basically, right now, there are lots of people who are trying to set up programs to recruit and train working class people to run for office. And those people are spending lots of time and energy and money on the assumption that what's missing right now is this sort of recruitment by political gatekeepers. Since people are spending money assuming that gatekeepers are the problem, part of my goal as a researcher is to see, are they right? Are they on the right track? Or is this type of strategy not really addressing some fundamental problem? And the last reason why I'm interested in studying political gatekeepers is simply other explanations haven't worked so far. So in the social sciences, my whole career as a political scientist has been essentially trying things and having a really strong hunch. And then I like to say the data disciplined my theorizing, which is to say I was wrong and I had to think of something else. The other explanations that I've looked at and the other people have looked at haven't panned out. Let me explain what I mean by that. So at bottom, if a social... So the reason why any social group is in office, it's always the result of a sort of winnowing process. So you imagine, here's your social group. It's any social group that you care about right now. It can be women, it can be single moms, any social group that you care about. Within that social group, only some of the people will actually be qualified to hold political office, will have the right set of skills, will have the right sort of legal criteria. 30-year-old can't be president. Someone who doesn't know who the president is probably shouldn't or can't be president. Within any social group, there are people who would make great politicians, and there are people who would not make great politicians. Within those people who would make great politicians, only a tiny number of them will ever actually run for political office. And of those who run, of course, not all of them are going to win. And if a given social group is sort of disproportionately unlikely to move on at any of these sort of three stages, let me stretch this out. So if people from that social group are less likely to be qualified than the people in other social groups, or if they're less likely to run, or if they're less likely to win, then at the end of the day, there's going to be less of that social group in our political institutions. And so I like to think of this as sort of three stages. There's a qualification stage. People from that group have to be qualified. There's the candidate entry stage. Those who are qualified have to run. And there's the election stage. Those who run have to win. And when I started doing research on this topic, what most people were telling me was it's about the qualifications or it's about the elections. Why are there so few working class people in public office, I would foolishly say at the airport. Because working class people are no good. Because they're too stupid and too lazy, and that's why they have blue collar jobs. And then what do you, no, it is, and what do you say in the airport to that? Yeah, no, those were, the one, the other version of this that I often heard is, well, it's, you know what, this is a democracy. If working class people aren't in public office, that is an expression of the will of the voters. Who are you to question that, professor? In my research, this is where I started. Now, I thought that both of these explanations were bogus. I didn't buy either one. But before I, you know, sort of launched my larger research agenda, I thought, let me check this. Because if it is true that working class people are less likely to hold office because they're less qualified or because voters don't want them, that might be a good reason to stop this research agenda right here. And I'll, again, spare you the gory details, although I'm always happy to talk about applied statistics. I really am. But neither explanation pans out. It turns out there are lots of blue-collar workers who have, at least on paper, the raw skills that seem to predict success in politics. There are lots of working-class Americans who follow politics, who are politically tolerant, who feel confident that they could make a difference in government, who participate in every other way. They vote, they volunteer, they go to election events. There seem to be so many working-class people who sort of seem like they have the raw materials to be political candidates, that this explanation just doesn't pan out when you look at the data. The other explanation that doesn't pan out is the voter story. So when working class candidates do run for office, they are totally unremarkable. They win about as often as anybody else. I've looked at actual data on congressional elections, and I found that working class candidates get vote margins that are statistically indistinguishable from the vote margins of business owners. A friend of mine, Meredith Sadin, at Berkeley, has done experiments where she's shown actual voters a hypothetical candidate, and she said, what do you think of this guy? His name is, oh, it's Ron something. But she doesn't tell them it's a hypothetical. She said, tell me about this candidate. Here's a brief biography of this candidate. And what she does, and she doesn't tell this to the person at the time, is randomly she varies whether the person sees a candidate who is a surgeon or a factory worker. Everything else about the candidate is the same. Same issue positions, same everything else, same backstory. Just one of them is a factory worker, one of them is a surgeon. Voters don't really care. They care about the issues. They care about the party. They care about what are you going to do for me in office. But voters seem to like blue-collar workers who run for public office just fine. They seem to do about the same in elections. So if working-class people are about as qualified to run for office as other social groups, as other sort of social classes, and if when they run, they tend to win about as often, by process of elimination, it must just be that they're not running as often as other people. It must be that qualified blue-collar workers are simply less likely to run. And so that's the explanation. Oh, these are the citations where me and then Meredith show these findings. that's where, you know, sort of I'm going to focus my research for the time being. I'm going to do two things. One of them I've already started. I want to know, first of all, in the short term, what's going on in the heads of qualified working class Americans? Why don't they want to run for office? Why don't they run for office? In the short term, what exactly is it that distinguishes between a qualified blue-collar worker who doesn't want to run for office and an equally qualified white-collar professional who does want to run for office? In the short term, I just want to answer that question. Why today aren't qualified working-class Americans running for office? I also think it's important to step back and think about, after we answer that, why does that difference exist in people's minds? What are the larger institutional or structural features of our political process that are leading certain classes of Americans to think, I belong in politics, and other classes of Americans to not feel that they belong in our political institutions? And so down the road, what I want to do is think through what are the structural features of our political process. Maybe it's how expensive elections have gotten. Maybe it's the decline of unions. Maybe it's the lack of role models. But the most immediate concern is this question, why don't qualified workers run for political office? Because once we know that, we can know what kinds of solutions we should be investing in. My explanation is essentially motivated by the research on why people participate in politics in general. And we know that people will participate in politics in lots of ways. Vote, go to a campaign rally, show up to a summer workshop. We know that people participate when three basic things happen. They can, they have the resources, they have the skills, they want to, they think politics is cool or at least a possible way to change the world, and someone asks them. How many of you, just out of curiosity, how many of you signed up for this program just reading about it passively online? How many of you were asked to participate in this program? Like someone you trust said you should do this? Yeah. Yeah, me too. I didn't intern for David because I was just like, oh, I should look for, you know, internship opportunities. I interned for David because my advisor, Professor Jeffrey Hockett, who's there in the back in the baseball cap, told me, hey, Nick, instead of being an attorney, you might want to consider a career in public policy. I think you should connect with David Blatt. People do things. People engage in the political process because they can and because they want to and because someone else invites them and helps them with that sort of first step, gets them over the hurdle of doing politics for the first time. So my theory going into this research project is that qualified working class Americans they're probably less likely to have the resources necessary to run for office, the free time and the free money that it takes to run a political campaign. They're probably less likely to want to run for political office. They may be less interested. They may be less likely to think of government as a way to actually make the world a better place. Lots of people are cynical. Lots of people think you can't do anything good with government anymore. And third, I think they're probably less likely to be encouraged to run for office by these gatekeepers, these people who are in the business of getting qualified people to do this crazy thing of running for public office. I don't mean crazy in a disparaging way. I mean to make the personal sacrifices to invest in public service in that way. And it takes a lot. And so that's the explanation that I'm focusing on. That's how all this fits together. So that's why I'm focusing on gatekeepers right now in my quest to answer this question. Why is that a crazy thing to do? Why not focus on gatekeepers? Well, the answer is, as a political scientist, what people find really persuasive in my field is quantitative data, numbers, hard evidence. And there aren't any. When I started this project, there were no ready-to-use data sets. So if I wanted to study politicians, if I want to study members of Congress, there are lots of data sets about members of Congress, right? I can tell you biographical information about members of Congress. I can tell you how they vote, the kinds of bills they introduce. It's all in big databases that are clean and well-formatted, ready to be run through Stata or SPSS or SAS or R or whatever you use. MATLAB? No MATLAB. Good for you. There are no rates. So surveys of gatekeepers almost never happened. No one even knows really how to define this population, people who encourage other people to run for public office. So almost no one surveys gatekeepers. And people do survey candidates sometimes, and they survey citizens constantly. But the people who are doing surveys of candidates and citizens never ask about class and gatekeeping. Yeah, so if you're ever in a public opinion survey, they're probably really interested in how you're going to vote in the gubernatorial election. And maybe they'll ask you what you do for a living or how much money you make or something like that at the end of the survey, but they're probably not going to ask you, has anyone ever encouraged you to run for political office? Because most of the people who do public opinion surveys are interested in what voters think or who they're going to vote for. And most of the people who survey candidates are just trying to attack the candidates. So most of the time when a candidate gets a survey, it's from the NRA, and it says, how will you vote? And they think, oh, gosh, how can I get out of taking this survey? Most of the time when people survey candidates, it's not political scientists who are just interested in why they ran for office and what made it easy and what made it hard and what they did for a living beforehand. Most surveys of candidates and most surveys of citizens, before I started this project, there was no survey that would let me answer this question in an empirically rigorous way. So I did a very crazy thing, which is I ran two surveys. In 2012, I teamed up with my friend Melody Crowdermeyer and my friend David Brockman, who's a PhD student at Berkeley, and my friend Chris Scovern is a PhD student at the University of Michigan. And we did a cooperative survey of everyone running for state legislature nationwide, which is about 10,000 candidates for state leg, incumbents, challengers, vanity candidates, nut jobs. That's not a scientific thing to say, nut jobs. Those of you who are thinking about a career in political science, that is not a term of our trade. That comes from my experience of getting hateful emails accusing me of crazy things. And then in 2013, we did a survey of everyone who's the chair of a county-level political party. Now, my co-author, Melody Crowdermeyer, had done a similar survey in 2008. She had found the chair of all 6,000 of the people who chair county-level political parties nationwide, found their mailing address, hand-addressed the envelope, licked the stamp, put it in the mail, did this big survey. Melody was really interested in why there are so few women in political office, and this is how she was able to show that party officials systematically underestimate women's chances to run for office. So we teamed up with David. I was interested in why there are so few blue-collar workers. David was interested in why there are so few racial and ethnic minorities. Melody wanted to study why there are so few women in office. Chris wanted to study why there are so few LGBT people running for public office. And so we thought, let's team up and do these surveys together. This combination of researchers did elicit quite a bit of... someone wrote to the Board of Trustees of Duke and called for me to be fired and said that it was a Tea Party candidate in New Hampshire. And said that we were basically an unholy alliance of the gay agenda, radical feminism, and class warfare and race warfare. Yep. What's really funny is, I won't say who, one of the four people is an independent, and one of the four people is a Republican. So this is not, you know, a far-left Democratic Party survey, but that's what we were accused of. All the trustees got it. It was a very interesting conversation with my dean. May I diverge just a little bit and tell you this story? So I get back. I'm teaching. It's my first semester of teaching at Duke University. I'm from Pittsburgh, Kansas, so I'm already terrified of everything going on around me. And I get back to my office. I've just taught what I thought was a terrific class on executive power. I get back to my office. I've missed 5 phone calls, which is weird because in the whole year I haven't gotten 5 phone calls. The first was from the office of the dean, the office of the provost, the office of federal relations, the office of the vice president, and the office of the guy who hired me, like Jay. And I'd missed these 5 calls, so my first thought was, my MacArthur Genius Grant has come in. My first thought was, pack up your stuff, Carnes. Back to Kansas. So I called my dean back, and he called me into his office. And he's an ex-Marine turned historian. He calls me into his office, sit down. And he was like, you got human subjects review. You got IRB approval to do this study, right? I was like, of course, Bruce. I can print it out for you. It's on my desk. And he's like, no, really. You got IRB approval for this, right? And I was like, yes, I promise. I will bring it to you in 2 seconds. He's like, okay. How do you want me to tell this guy to go to hell? So I live to carry on my research agenda another day. That's the story of the National Candidate Study. The National Survey of Party Leaders was a lot less contentious. Party officials are sort of more used to getting this kind of correspondence. They're more typically, they're people who've been in politics longer, so they're less likely to sort of construct conspiracy theories about academic researchers. So just to give you a sense of the scope of what we were doing, and the reason why, by the way, I was not surprised. When Melody ran her survey in 2009 or 2008, she got lots of hate mail because she was one woman writing from Princeton University. So there was a lot of woman bashing. There was a lot of Ivy League bashing in the responses to her. We intentionally created a team of people who were interested in different topics, who had different registered party backgrounds, who came from different types of universities. And when you survey as many people as we did, you should expect to get some people who are just, they're having a bad day, and they're really angry that they got your survey. And so, I mean, our survey, the National Candidate Study, there were approximately 10,000 declared candidates for state legislature in August of 2012. Of those, we were surprised. About 2,000 responded. At the time, the Pew Survey Research Centers, when you see, you know, Pew in parentheses behind some polling number, Pew was getting about a 9% response rate, calling people to ask them 5 questions, basically. And we got a 20% response rate sending a letter in the mail or an email with a long online survey to people actively campaigning for public office. We had initially thought we were going to get a 5% response rate, and that was going to be fine. It was going to be a pilot study. We got 20%, and so we said, this is a real survey. We can really learn from this. We asked a lot of different questions on that survey. One of the things we asked was, what do politicians think their constituents think? So if you saw, like, on your Facebook feed about a year ago, this study that found that politicians think their constituents are more conservative than they really are, that was this survey. So we asked that. We asked what makes running for office easy and what makes it hard. So we wanted to just know systematically, what are the real sacrifices, barriers, challenges for political candidates? What is it that they go through? And then for my purposes and for the purposes of my co-author's research, we just want to know who's actually running for public office. What are the racial backgrounds of candidates? What are the gender backgrounds of candidates? What are the class backgrounds of candidates? Before this survey, no one knew what percentage of state legislative candidates had a college degree. Right? We knew the percentage of state legislators, the winners, who had college degrees. NCSL compiles those data. But we didn't know anything about this important group of people who runs, candidates themselves. And importantly, for the purposes of what I thought was one of the most promising explanations, we asked who was being encouraged to run for public office. When we did the same thing again in 2013, we had a similar size population. It was a little more complicated. We surveyed the 6,000 Republican and Democratic Party leaders in each county in the country, unless your state is organized by parish, like Louisiana, or borough, or district. In the state of Connecticut, the Democrats, or in the state of Massachusetts, the Democratic Party is actually so well organized there and so numerous that they don't have county parties or even city parties. They have sort of like neighborhood-wide Democratic Party offices. So we just surveyed, you know, sort of the equivalent of the county-level Republican and Democratic Party in every state. We decided to do it unintrusively, so we only surveyed in states where the party made some information about who the leaders of the county-level branches were available online or were willing to give us that information if we asked. So if a state, including Oklahoma, if neither party had at that time a list of the chairs of the county-level parties on the internet, and if when we asked they said no or they didn't answer, we did not go through the phone book trying to find county party chairs. We sort of said, based on our experiences with the negative reception to our candidate survey, we are going to let sleeping dogs lie. And if there's a state where people don't want to be contacted, that's just fine. We got 801 responses to email, 330 to postal mail. We asked a wide range of questions, things like, how is the party organized? No one actually knows what county-level political parties look like nationwide. Everyone knows what their own county party is like. We asked how party leaders identify and recruit citizens. And again, we asked, who's running for office in your county, and what did you do to encourage them? So with these two surveys together, we can really get what I think is a pretty neat perspective. To my surprise and delight, there was essentially no pattern in who answered our surveys. Incumbent state legislators were just as likely as their challengers. Vanity candidates were just as likely as candidates who got lots of votes. There was no sort of, my big fear was we were going to see, in a lot of graphs of the U.S., the South really stands out. Look at, you know, lots of different measures, party identification, health outcomes. My fear was we were going to see either the South had a really high response rate or really low response rate, and then we're going to have to figure out what to do with that. To my surprise, these states that are totally blacked out are the states where we didn't have anyone to contact. We had no contact information. And then the darker blue states here are the ones where we got lots of responses. The lighter blue ones are the states where we got fewer responses. There was no really striking geographic pattern. So it looks like the people who took our surveys were just the people who felt like taking the survey on the day they got it, which is fine. We can deal with cases being missing at random. What we can't deal with is we only got responses from incumbents, not challengers. We only got responses from Democrats, not Republicans. That would be a problem. But the surveys were, you know, by survey standards, pretty well behaved. What these two surveys did was, for the first time ever, they gave us two different perspectives on the role of gatekeeping and why there are so few working class people in political office. With the National Candidate Study, we were able to ask, are working class candidates getting less encouragement to run for public office? The people who have decided to run, if they're from the working class, are they getting less? Were they getting less encouragement to do it? And we can ask then, well, let's ask the people doing the encouraging. Let's get their side of the story. Are party leaders actually less likely to encourage working class candidates to run for public office? On the National Candidate Study, we started very early in the survey with a question, what's your occupation? And if being a politician is your occupation, or if you're retired, what did you do before that? This question was useful because it first allowed me to just confirm my sense, which I told you earlier, that the action is not happening at the election stage. I wanted to be sure using this survey that it was not the case that blue-collar workers are just running and losing. I wanted to be sure that it really is they're not running in the first place. And sure enough, if you look, the percentage of the general population who's from a working-class job is still about 54%. The percentage of people who win state legislative elections in 2012 who had working-class jobs was about 2%. Any guesses as to what percentage of candidates had working-class jobs? Closest without going over. Four, two, $1. It was three. So all of the action is happening. It's not that working-class people are just running and losing. It's not that voters are saying no. Working-class people just aren't running in big numbers in the first place. So what about this idea that they're not being encouraged? Well, one of the things we did on this survey of candidates was we asked, the first time you ever ran for a major public office, how many of these different types of people encouraged you to run, and how many of them discouraged you, said don't do it? What we found when we asked this question this way was that no one was willing to say, I was told not to run for public office. No, very few people checked that they were discouraged to run by anyone. But there was a lot of differences in how much encouragement people said they got and who they said they got it from. So if I added up just the percentage of candidates in our survey who said they were encouraged to run by a state, local, or national interest group leader, which again, I think would include David Blatt. So if you were encouraged to run by David, the way we define interest groups, you'd be in there, David. The percentage, and then I just broke that down by occupation. And you don't have to read all these. You just have to know that these are all white-collar jobs, and this dark gray category, these are working-class candidates. Working-class candidates were less likely than any other occupational group in the survey to say that they were encouraged to run for public office the first time by an interest group. They were also the least likely to say they were encouraged to run by a sitting politician or by some other civic leader. They were least likely to say that a journalist encouraged them to run. The one exception to this pattern was party leaders. Basically, everybody who runs for office seems to say, yeah, the party eventually gave me their blessing to run. But here, there was really not a big difference. They were sort of, you know, a point or two ahead of the others. But if you just add up the total amount of check marks, the total number of times different types of groups that our candidates were saying encouraged them to run, working-class people, working-class candidates scored dead last in our survey. They were least likely to be encouraged to run for public office by people already in government, even though, and this was the kicker, the candidates in our survey from the working class seemed, by the ways we could measure it, to be just as qualified as the other candidates in the survey. So we asked a lot of questions about the first time you ran for office, were you really concerned about a whole bunch of different issues, raising money, actually winning, actually holding the office. And we sort of said, you know, when you first ran, we essentially asked, were you a strong candidate or were you sort of a shaky candidate? Working class candidates were right in the middle of the pack in terms of the proportion who said, I wasn't really worried about fundraising the first time I ran for public office. They were right in the middle of the pack, surprisingly, when they said, I didn't really worry about losing my job. Everybody worries about losing their job when they run for public office, was sort of the message here. Working class candidates were the most willing of any occupational group to say they were fine giving up their free time to run for public office. So working class candidates in our survey seemed to be just as qualified in the ways we could measure as the other candidates we were surveying, but they got the least encouragement to run from political gatekeepers. Do working class candidates get less encouragement? When we surveyed candidates, the answer seemed to be yes, they do. Anybody who's a parent, I have a 5-year-old, anybody who's a parent knows you always get the other kid's side of the story. Candidates are saying it's the gatekeeper's fault. They're not saying that, but candidates are indicating that it's the gatekeeper's fault. So we also did this survey of party leaders, and we wanted to get their side of the story. Are party leaders less likely to encourage working class candidates to run for office? We did this in a fairly simple way. We just asked, in the last few elections, what percentage of these groups were working class people? The potential candidates you tried to recruit, the candidates who actually ran, and the people who won. What party leaders told us is that, well, we know in the public about 54% of people have working class jobs. Party leaders told us about 1 in 4 of the people they recruited to run for office were blue collar workers, and about 30% ran, and about 28% actually won. So party leaders told us, essentially, that they were less likely to encourage working class people than the number of working class people who are out there in the general public. And here's the thing. These numbers are almost certainly reflecting what we call a halo effect. Party leaders were probably, you know, picking up on the fact that they should say a high number and telling us a high number. Even with their halos on, they were still admitting that they're less likely to encourage a working class person to run for office. But we can actually take their halos off. In the state of California, they require candidates to say what their occupation is when they run for public office. And so we have data on the actual percentage going up to 2010 of candidates and office holders from the working class in California. And in California, at the county level, which is the offices we're interested in, it's never been more than 5% going back to 1996, candidates from the working class. When we did our survey, California county party leaders told us that they tried to recruit 30% working class candidates, that 25% of the actual candidates were from the working class, and that 15% of the people who won elections were blue-collar workers. And averages that just have to be wrong. Or maybe there was a major transformation of California politics that no one in the world heard about. So it looks like party leaders, even with their halos on, are still admitting that they are less likely to help a blue-collar worker run for office than a white-collar professional. Why? I'm running a little short on time, so I'm just going to skip to the punchline here. And the answer is, these red bars mean, we asked you, do you think working-class people are less qualified, harder to convince to run, worse at fundraising, worse at campaigning, or less preferred by voters? And party leaders were consistently willing to tell us, yeah, I think working-class candidates are less qualified. I have the data to tell you that's probably not true. And they also said, we think working class candidates are less likely to win an election. We think voters don't like them as much. 30% of party leaders nationwide, and there's no difference between Republicans and Democrats, 1 in 3 party leaders basically says a working class candidate is less likely to win, and that is factually untrue. Nationwide, in survey experiments, that's just plain wrong. Party leaders see workers as bad candidates. I'll spare you the alternative explanation, just tell you. They aren't looking in the wrong places. They're really just thinking working class people don't make good candidates. We asked candidates themselves, are political gatekeepers less likely to help the working man? They said yes. We asked party leaders, are they less likely to encourage working class candidates? They too said yes. So what does all this mean? What should you remember, if anything, from my time with you today? Well, I think it means that party or political gatekeepers are partly to blame for why there are so few working class Americans in political office. So, you know, that's part of, I think, the larger explanation that we need to pay attention to. And that's sort of satisfying intellectually, because we find the same thing when we look at other historically underrepresented groups. So it looks like the same kinds of processes that lead party leaders to underestimate women may be also leading them to underestimate working class people. I think there's a message in here for people in my discipline and the field of political science that just in general, we need to be paying more attention to this process of candidate recruitment. We need to be paying more attention to who's being pushed to run for office, not just surveying the people who already are in office, but actually thinking about how can we contact the people who do political gatekeeping. And I think the other important implication of this research is that the people who are doing reforms right now, gatekeeping reforms to try to encourage more working class Americans to hold public office, I think they're probably on the right track. Since the mid-1990s, the New Jersey AFL-CIO has been running a labor candidate school. They find politically qualified blue-collar workers, train them in how to run for public office. The graduates of that school have a 75% win rate. They're in every level of the New Jersey government, from city council all the way up to state legislature. And that program is starting to spread. The Nevada AFL-CIO launched a campaign boot camp for blue-collar workers 2 years ago. In Maine, they've had one for 1 year. In Oregon, they have a three-year-old labor candidate school. The message of my research is the people who are investing in these kinds of reforms, they're probably on the right track. What needs to happen from here? Well, so I think that candidates and party leaders they're telling me that gatekeepers aren't encouraging blue-collar workers. In the future, I would also like to talk to qualified citizens, actually do that phone survey where we say, are you qualified to run for office? Have you ever been asked to run for office? We won't do it exactly like that, but we've actually already sort of put in motion a national survey of people who seem to be qualified for public office. We still need to actually measure the effects of gatekeeping, so it would be really nice to see if I do recruit blue-collar workers, how much of an effect does that have? Can we overcome the gatekeeping gap that's keeping workers out right now? I still want to go back and study these other two factors. I think personal resources and an interest in running for office are an important part of the equation in terms of who runs, or an important part of the explanation for why so few working-class people run. And once we understand sort of what's going on at the individual level, what's going on in the heads of blue-collar workers who aren't running, I think it's important for us to step back and say, what are the bigger structural characteristics of our society that make it hard for people without resources to run for office, or that make it so that some types of people don't see themselves as qualified, or some types of people aren't being encouraged? I think that's an eventual goal of my research. We know, for instance, that states that have more unions tend to have more working class people in their legislatures, that states where working class people are more involved in the political party tend to have more working class people in the legislature. So it seems like this isn't just in people's heads. This is a part of our political process that we can change. And above all, a big part of my future research is going to be turning my academic research into real action. The worst advice I ever got when I was in your shoes. You ready for this? Just write your dissertation, and then people will read it and change the world. You laugh, but this idea is shockingly prevalent among academic researchers and researchers in the world of public policy who will think, I'm going to do the study, I'm going to identify the problem, and then someone else is going to come along and solve it because I did the hard work of sounding the alarm. And the best advice I got on this particular subject came from David Blatt when I worked for him at the Community Action Project of Tulsa County. David said, if I may, I spent years writing a dissertation, but probably fewer than 50 people ever actually read it. I spent Monday morning writing a press release, and thousands of Oklahomans will read it and pay attention to an important problem. There's a real lesson in that. I confirmed earlier this week, I guess yesterday, with the Princeton University Library that my dissertation has never been checked out in the 3 years since I submitted it in partial completion of my doctorate. If we just follow the advice, if you build it, they will come. If you do the research, they will read it and change the world. We're never going to change the world. You will probably hear some version of this argument at some point in your career, and I hope you will tell whoever's saying it they're crazy. If you care about a problem or a cause or an issue, you just cannot sit on the sidelines and wave your hands and scream. You really have to get in the game. And so that's what I'm going to do. So 2 weeks ago, I got the funding, so I can officially announce for the first time publicly that in 2015, in March, I will be running the first ever North Carolina Workers to Leaders program to train blue-collar workers in my state. Based on the models that have been developed in Oregon and Nevada and New Jersey, we will hopefully try to train blue-collar workers in North Carolina to run for public office. There is a real part of me, I have a 5-year-old, I'm tired all the time, and I'm trying to get tenure, and there's a real part of me that just would love to sit on the sidelines on this one and not get involved and just hope that someone else will fix this problem I have identified. But I have learned that if I do that, nothing will happen. If I don't take this on, I'm only going to be voting for white-collar candidates. So thank you all so much for having me.